Welcome to Talking New Energy, a podcast from LCP Delta. I'm John Sloan.
And I'm Sandra Trittin. And together we are exploring how the energy transition is unfolding across Europe through conversations with guests from the leading edge of the transition.
Hi, Sandra.
Hey, John, how are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm fine, thanks. Looking forward to today's episode.
Yeah, because we'd be talking about, well, many things, but change and disruption. And those are two things that the energy sector needs plenty of. Some might be a bit uncomfortable with the disruption, but I think that's what we're seeing and going to see more of.
Exactly. And there are some companies who are, let's say, at the forefront of change, right? And there's one specifically that stands out, and not only because of the nice pinky animal it has in its branding, which is Octopus Energy.
Yeah, so it's great to be talking today with one of the senior team at Octopus Energy, Alex Skosch, who's Global Head of Flexibility and Electrification.
Exactly, and also I know Alex already for a long time, even from Tesla.
Okay, so another disruptor company.
Exactly.
So let's get on with the discussion and say hello. Hello, Alex.
Hi, John. Hi, Sandra. Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Welcome to the podcast.
Welcome.
Alex, can you start by describing a couple of things? First of all, Octopus Energy. I'm guessing most of our listeners will have heard of Octopus, but maybe a few facts or figures and stats to give everyone an idea of the scale and size you are today. And then secondly, your role at Octopus.
Yeah, absolutely. So Octopus Energy Group was founded in 2015. And can broadly be kind of broken up into four major areas of focus. We have our power and gas retailing business, where we're active in eight countries, eight deregulated markets around the world, including the UK, France, Italy, Spain, Germany, Japan, New Zealand, and Texas.
That's a challenge with a lot of growth, Alex. You've got to keep the list in your head.
Well, you know, the thing is that our kind of company presentation slides are constantly out of date. So we have this kind of whole, you know, dance where we kind of go, oh, sorry, that number is wrong. It's there's another million customers. So speaking of customers, we have over 7.5 million customers that we serve in our retail business. We're now actually the largest electricity supplier in the UK from a standing start in 2015. We also manage over $7 billion of generation assets as part of our generation business. So that's, you know, renewables across the UK, Western Europe, and rapidly expanding our footprint beyond that. We have projects in development in South Korea, in Sierra Leone, amongst other markets around the world.
And those are wind farms, solar farms, big chunky generation assets.
Yeah, exactly that. And we then have our services businesses, if you will, is like the third major part of the Octopus Energy Group. So basically everything you need to accelerate the electrification of transport and heating. So we have a EV leasing business. We sell and install smart meters, EV charge points, solar and storage and heat pumps in a lot of the markets that we're operating in. And we also have heat pump R&D and actually even manufacturing, which we're ramping up at the moment with our new Cozy range. And last but not least, we have our Kraken technology platform, which not only runs the whole other parts of the businesses that I've just run through, but we also license it to other utilities around the world. We have over 54 million accounts licensed on Kraken.
Okay, so grown a lot since starting in 2015. Roughly how many people, or give us an idea of the sort of scale of the organization in terms of the operations and where you sit in it, I guess.
Yeah, so we have about 6,000 employees currently globally, across the various businesses that form the group, and it's exciting growth.
It's really impressive. And can you probably explain a little bit what your role is in that organization?
Sure. So I look after everything that we do around flexibility, which, you know, is a bit of a horrible industry term, to be honest. But, you know, when we think about So everything about how we kind of harness new forms of flexibility, how we monetize it, how we build products and services and solutions for customers, whether those are domestic customers or industrial customers. And then on the electrification front, you know, how do we continue speeding up the electrification of heating and transport, which is so critical to getting to net zero, but doing this in a sustainable way that really kind of helps speed up how our whole energy ecosystem gets digitized and automated.
And what would you see currently as the biggest challenge in that electrification? Because you're actually raising a good point, right? We have to speed up. We don't have to lose time. What would you see as one of the biggest hurdles around that?
So when I think about what's the longest pole in the tent, so to say, it comes down to distribution networks. Mm-hmm. So the actual networks that transport the electrons to our houses, mm-hmm. To our charging stations, to the offices and factories. And the reason I say that is, as part of this transition, we're really flipping the whole energy system on its head. We're moving from a few thousand power, generators, big power stations that are scheduled and planned in a very kind of static way. And they're all just pushing, electrons from from the generation point to the consumption point. It's a one direction flow, voltages being stepped up and stepped down, but that's kind of it. And now we're in a world where, in the UK alone, for example, we already have millions of generators. We have multiple millions of devices on the road that can be smart and are part of the kind of balancing of the grid and matching supply and demand in real time. And it's only going to get more complex. And to deal with this complexity and also this opportunity, because actually we can, mm-hmm. Make sure that every electron travels the least distance necessary from point of generation to point of consumption, there's a huge digitization challenge. And that's also, that challenge is especially true in the low voltage world, because right now it is a black hole from a visibility perspective. So, no one knows what exactly is happening on that power line, from the last transformer to your house. And so when I think about the biggest challenge, it's that challenge.
Which is interesting, I think, because on one side, the distribution grid operator sits in that sandwich position between the transmission grid, right, and the end consumer. But looking back, like even 5-6 years, when you were talking to some of the distribution grid operators, they were all like, oh, we are fine, right? We just put a bit more of copper and everything will be good. And all of a sudden it pops up and everyone wakes up, luckily, and says like, now we have to improve, right?
Yeah, I mean, the infinite bus bar approach is not only wildly inefficient and an incredible waste of customer money. I mean, at the end of the day, we also have to remember that, this is all paid for by consumers. And so, just saying, we're just going to build more poles and wires just to kind of, and build for peak in the same way that we've built our whole infrastructure for the past 100 years. Just, it feels like wildly off.
Alex, I completely agree that the distribution net will become more and more of a bottleneck. And I was speaking with one of the distribution companies in the UK, and his strategy was, we don't want to be a blocker. Desperately, I can see the potential for distribution networks to be a blocker. And his was desperately looking at how they could not be a blocker in the next years for electrification. What do you see as Octopus's role in this? So how can Octopus help with that, as you say, biggest pole in the tent challenge?
So we think about this from kind of multiple angles. On the one hand, as an energy system, we have seen a net reduction in overall electricity consumption for the past 2+ decades. And now we're looking at a doubling in less than a decade. And so, and that is really coming from these two major electrification trends. So one big way of how we look at helping solve this is by managing that demand. and managing that demand intelligently. I'll go on a quick soapbox moment, if you'll allow me, John. Demand-side response is a term that we should not be using anymore. It is an outdated term that was, you know, conceived for when we had coal power stations and nuclear power plants that had to run baseload and, you know, couldn't really kind of ramp them down significantly overnight. And so we talk about, demand-side response to keep things running, to keep our power generators running in the same way, you know, Economy 7 is really designed for that with storage heaters.
It's framed in the old paradigm, isn't it?
Exactly. And so What we need to be talking about is intelligent demand, demand that is responsive to the volatilities of making sure that we are always consuming greenest electrons that are generated closest to the consumption point so that we're not curtailing, you know, those wonderfully cheap, incredibly cheap green electrons that are generated. Sorry, soapbox moment over.
No, I like it.
but I fully agree with you, Alex. Normally it would be more like a demand management or like in general, energy supply management kind of systematics, right?
Exactly. So back to John, back to your question. So on the one hand, it's how do we manage that demand, that growing demand intelligently? On the other hand, as part of one part of Kraken, actually is called is Kraken Grid, where we have a monitoring solution that can be installed at secondary substations and lower and provides kind of real-time visibility to network operators as well as predictive fault analysis and power quality of visibility. So we kind of approach it at both ends, both kind of providing the network operator with the tools and the platforms to do that in a modern kind of scalable way. From a tech perspective, and then also helping manage the demand.
And the Kraken Grid angle, come back to intelligent demand in a minute, but the Kraken Grid angle, is that because you saw a need and a gap that, you know, you saw a gap in the market, the demand would be there for this product or this type of service, and you filled it, or was that more opportunistic? Yeah, tell me a bit about what drove that, because that's quite different from the rest of Octopus that you described earlier.
Yeah, we definitely see a need for it, and we see a need for a modern kind of scalable tech solution that isn't part of an existing kind of macro framework of how, you know, what the, you know, the very big lumbersome tech implementations that these exist, you know, that the network operators have today, which was fit for purpose, you know, 10 years ago. But now, you know, they need to move much faster. And so we looked at it like, you know, what are our core, you know, our core DNA is how do we build technology fast in an iterative manner to help solve problems of today and tomorrow. And so that's where we saw this kind of, you know, the speed at which network operators were able to get tech to actually install it, test it, and then get visibility just wasn't happening fast enough with the existing income.
Well, from the traditional suppliers of network equipment, yeah, the lead times are low, the way they work, it's hardware-based, the software and the tech is wrapped around the hardware.
You've got it.
And what's the reaction been from the network companies? Are you in the early stages of Kraken Grid, or tell us a bit about how that's going.
It's going very well, actually. We have we have customers in multiple markets, in the UAE, in Norway, in Cyprus, in Switzerland. So it's growing very fast, actually.
Yeah, very exciting.
Finally, there is a market for it.
Let's go back to intelligent demand now and unpack that a bit. So I think most, Sandra and I, sort of live in this world of intelligent demand, much nicer phrase than demand side response. A lot of our listeners will. Tell us a bit about how you think about that at Octopus, how you break that down or framework or building blocks for that.
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think, you know, the way that we think about it is very, like, always with the mindset of what is the customer proposition and what is the customer experience. Because, you know, it's very easy to fall into a trap to build products and solutions that are optimized for yourself as the business, or optimized for a specific market construct. It's much harder to think and work at what is the simplest, easiest to understand proposition or product that gives the end customer an incredible benefit. And then in the background, you can kind of deal with the complexity. And let me give an example. We have a EV smart charging tariff called Intelligent Octopus Go, where in the Octopus app, customers can sign up in less than 5 minutes. And to the point that they sign up, they authenticate their car or their charge point. We connect it to Kraken. We send a command to confirm that we've connected to that device. We get the telemetry back from that device saying, you know, we've authenticated this car or this charge point. And then it's done. Then you're onboarded. You're on the, you know, and the customer proposition is every kilowatt hour that your car is smart charging according to Octopus's smart charging schedule, you're getting a, you know, 66% discount on your unit rate. So you're paying 7.5p for all of that electricity, not just the electricity going to the car, but the whole home. So that allows customers to save £600-£700 a year for charging their car. That's it. The only thing the customers need to do is set when they want the car ready by and what state of charge. In the background, we deal with, you know, how does that change our kind of power trading positions? How do we market that, you know, the aggregated capacity to DSOs? How do we, you know, market that capacity to the transmission operator in various services and markets? But the customer needs are always paramount.
I imagine you always, well, you think about the whole system and the opportunities to provide services to the DSO or the transmission system operator. But that starting point with a customer, I would imagine that different, or I can see that differentiates you from a number of other companies. If that passion is always there about delivering an incredible experience to the customer. So that seems fairly ingrained in your culture and how
it
works.
It absolutely is, because, you know, what is the central ingredient to this being something that is adopted is trust. And the utility sector, if it's one thing it's poor on, is consumer trust. And so, of course, you know, that is a fundamental central pillar of our company culture, because if customers don't trust us to do the best thing and the right thing for them, then all of this other stuff is, you know, remains an academic exercise.
Mm-hmm. And I think this goes a bit along with all the, let's say, neo utilities or newcomers in the market. And this is really impressive, done also by Octopus, right? This focus on the consumer, how to make it easy, and then in a second step, look on how you make the processes working behind. Whereas if you look at the old world, it was always like, how can we make the processes work? And then you see the mess up to the customer side, right? Where people have to wait to change their metering and settlement for more than 6 months in Germany, what I recently heard, right? Which is ridiculous.
Yeah, you know, I kind of see this every day, really. You know, talking with other actors in the utility space industry, or with manufacturers of different devices. They're like, oh, but, you know, what are the criteria that you make the customer do? Like, surely they must have to plug in at, you know, certain time, and, you know, they must do this and must do that. I'm like, no, you know, we collect 2.9 billion rows of data a day. And it's on us to use that data to build our forecast, build the confidence in what we need to achieve. Like that is our risk to bear. Like you can't expect, you might be able to get a few early adopters who are super keen on participating and stuff doing that. That will never be a mass market thing. And I think it's actually, you know, think about the, you know, cast your mind back, you know, 20, 25 years, the complexity of mobile phone contracts and plans. And then think about how incredibly straightforward they are now. You know, they address different customer needs, different customer segments. They're very easy to understand. And you can switch between them also relatively easily. And I think that's the, you know, I think if there's a good kind of parable, that's probably the evolution of consumer offerings in the mobile telephone space and kind of mobile and mobile space versus what's going to happen in energy and over this coming decade.
What do you think the biggest challenge is to get to that, where we are today with mobile phones and the contracts you described, Alex? Not just for, well, either for you or Octopus or the sector in general. What worries you the most about really unlocking intelligent demand?
Well, and Sandra, I think will echo this. The single biggest foundational step is smart meters.
Fully agree.
I mean, you know, like, you know, without that, this remains a purely theoretical discussion. And like, you know, and you know, the things that worry me the most in that regard is look at what's happened in Germany now with the vaunted paragraph 14A, which, you know, is, if anything, this horrendous, terrible, terrible compromise of, you know, okay, network operators, you don't have the tools to actually do anything about managing your network. So we're just going to give you a big red button to kind of turn off large loads that are installed. Like, it's just like, you know, it's crazy, really. I mean, in the same way,
it's definitely not intelligent demand, is it?
No, I mean, it's like, you know, it's brute force. It's, you know, it's what happened in South Australia as well, where with the rapid increase in rooftop residential solar, you know, 1 in 4, you know, 25% of all housing stock had solar. You know, the network the DNSP there, you know, got the similar big red button. Now, of course, you know, like, I would argue that, you know, in the South Australian case, the need was more acute, but it still, I don't think it was the right approach to take, because, you know, the better approach to take would be allow the market, put out the price signals that say, and then allow the market to iterate.
And there's no shortage of innovators and innovation in the market that will respond to that. We've learned that over the years.
I think on the technology side, right, we are fully there. It's really only about how to make the market design and how to build up the business model. But currently, I don't see the challenge on the technical side.
Alex, I'd like to ask you, looking back over the last few years at Octopus, what's gone faster than you thought and what's gone slower? So maybe pick out something that has been more of a challenge than you thought it would be, and something that, wow, that's accelerated quickly.
Great question, John. I think if I look at what's gone slower, it's a great example how whole system thinking is a critical element to ensuring that this transition happens at pace. And so in that context, the kind of government policy and regulatory framework, I don't think has kind of taken that whole system thinking to the logical conclusion of where it should be, to kind of have consistent policies to drive wholesale market reform, for example, a big topic in the UK, or for that matter, you know, provide consistent confidence on electrification of heating as being, you know, the primary strategy. We still hear rumblings around hydrogen for domestic heating, which is bonkers, right? It's the most inefficient thing you could possibly do. And you've got heat pumps that are magic that, you know, you put in 1 kilowatt hour of electricity and you get 3 kilowatt hour, you know, 3 units of heat out. Like, so I'd say that, you know, in the context of declaring a climate emergency, of actually seeing not only the fundamental thing that we need to tackle, which is climate change, but also the huge economic opportunity that this presents, I think that has been, you know, slower.
Has that slowed you down at Octopus as well? Compared, you know, if you think of your plans for electrifying heat, for example, or capturing the value of flexibility and value stacking?
To a degree. I think more broadly, though, you know, it's not just about Octopus. It's about the whole market. And it's about having, you know, businesses that, you know, we're very fortunate. We have fantastic investors who have a very long-term view on where this transition is going. And we have a leadership team that wholeheartedly believes in this. There are other businesses where, you know, you need stronger signals or clarity to make investment calls. And the longer that those investment calls aren't made or aren't really doubled down on, you know, the bigger impact to, you know, accelerating this transition across the board.
And then one thing that's gone quicker or faster or surprised you?
So this is maybe a bit more tactical than the what's gone slower answer. The demand flexibility service in the UK. So, you know, this went from a octopus funded trial of 100,000 customers with National Grid ESO, 2.5 years ago, to a service that is available to all customers, you know, whether that's business or domestic customers via either suppliers or aggregators, and is now in its second kind of season of operation. For me, why it's gone faster is that it shows the power of how to do innovation in the real world and iterating in the real world, and not in the historical, industry approach of kind of segmented off innovation projects that are completely, you know, move at such a slow pace that, you know, by the time they're finished, the market has changed. And that's even more powerful now, because very few people, if you really ask them, can truly articulate what exponential growth or exponential change means. And so if you have people looking 5 years back being like, oh, well, you know, that's ready now, like that doesn't work anymore.
Mm. And what would you think made this intelligent demand management so successful?
I think the demand flexibility service was very successful and, you know, continues to grow because, A, you know, it engages consumers in a way that, you know, the electricity industry hasn't done before, right? I mean, like, it's a complete opt-in. It's an ability to kind of, you know, like, you know, I want to do this, in the same way that, you know, you go to the supermarket and some people will go for the bargain kind of, the bargain bucket of, you know, stuff that is, you know, marked down. Other people go like, no, I want this brand of, you know, of flour or this brand of drink. And I think what it does, it opens up optionality, and I think it's a very important example of how you can harness consumers, even in what is essentially a manual, you know, quite manual activation, to deliver some, gigawatt hours of demand shifting.
I think it's been fantastic. Millions of customers participating in that really manual, quite clunky service, but shows what's possible.
Exactly. And it shows what's possible. And for me, that's so important, because you kind of, instead of waiting for the perfect technical solution, which, you know, requires digitization across the energy, you know, a space, as we talked about before, it kind of signposts a very clear evolution that you can do whilst taking the consumers and the customers of the energy system on that journey with you, instead of kind of iterating in kind of closed doors meeting rooms, thinking about the future of tomorrow without ever actually talking to humans, being like, would you actually like this?
Sandra, I'm thinking back to our previous podcast discussion with the International Energy Agency and how hard it is for policymakers to make the right decisions. And I think that's a brilliant example of being able to innovate, take some risk, but manage those risks, and that very rapid feedback loop, so we don't get stuck in these five-year innovation programs, as you described, Alex. I don't know what you think, Sandra. Is that chime with you?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this was at the end of our last discussion, right, where I said we know that the regulator has to change and that guidelines will have to change in the long run, laws, etc. But we cannot wait for it, right? We have that time pressure to get that energy transition happen. And so we need to find ways on how to implement new solutions already today. And then for sure they will improve, right? Once the regulation changes, it gets much easier. I think what is most important, that regulation should not put additional hurdles into the system. I think this is even more crucial than helping to push it forward, because I think there is a lot of push going on through newcomers, startups, etc. There are solutions out there, but at least the regulator should have in mind not to put additional difficulties into the system, and at best even support these new solutions.
Difficult job being a regulator.
As I said, would not be my dream job, right?
Alex, one last question. I'd like to look back to your experience with Tesla and Octopus, and I guess less, I don't know if you would share the view that Octopus and Tesla are disruptors, or you'd use that word or categorize them in that way. They both have, I think, disrupted the automotive and now the energy sector. Any views or reflections on what it's like working with these companies, or reflections on what's sort of key takeaways that have enabled Tesla and Octopus to really succeed in the way they have?
That's a great question, John. I think there's a couple things to come to mind. But one of the most salient things is at both organizations, there is such a strong mission-driven culture. You know, it's not a profitability-driven culture. It's not a, it is a culture that is very much driven to accelerate, you know, a sustainable world using technology, whether that's, you know, battery and drivetrain and manufacturing technology or software to, you know, digitize and run the whole energy system. And that, you know, that then attracts a certain type of individual. And quite frankly, I've been privileged to work with some of the smartest people that I will ever have met, both at Tesla and at Octopus. And you know that is the single biggest, you know if you have a really hard problem to solve, you want to surround yourself with people way smarter than you, who have, you know, a shared passion and mission to achieve something that, you know, most people would say is impossible.
How's that mission kept front of mind at Octopus, or how do you talk about that all the time? Does it permeate all the conversations? Is it just alignment of the people and what you all are driven by?
I think it deeply permeates everything that we do. And, you know, we have at Octopus every Friday afternoon, we have family dinner, which is a tradition that started long before I joined the company. It was like, you know, when the company was less than 6 months old, of everyone going to the pub and talking about the week, about what went well and what didn't go well. It's now a bit more formalized. But we have, you know, highlights from around the world from all the different divisions and parts of the company. Centered to that is, how have we helped customers? How have we, you know, what have we done to help customers today? What have we done to kind of push forward, building new technology, you know, changing markets, building more generation, that is kind of central to everything that we do.
Well, journey's been amazing so far, and I'm sure it will be amazing in the next years, Alex, which takes us on to the Talking New Energy crystal ball. So I'd like to set the dial to 2030, so 6 years' time. And can you give us a view from 2030 as to where we'll be at with electrification and flexibility?
Well, on the electrification front, even the esteemed analyst team at BNEF are consistently wrong and underbake how many EVs are put on the road. So I would say, you know, whatever their forecast is, plus 25%. It's kind of like, and the way that I think about this is like, look at the trillions of dollars that in the past 15 years have been invested into electrification of transport, you know, and the whole supply chain, from anode and cathode production to battery cell production to the continued dropping in dollars per kilowatt hour cost of batteries, to the commitments of, you know, incumbent legacy automakers desperately trying to catch up. to, you know, what we're seeing, you know, Chinese manufacturers coming out, to Tesla's continued domination of the EV space, especially in North America and Europe. So on that, you know, on that front, I think, you know, I don't think that is, we're going to see any change. I mean, we should probably expect some battery chemistry kind of improvements. Jury's out on whether solid state batteries will be anywhere near mainstream or pure promise. I don't think fuel cell technology will make any material kind of jumps. And I think that actually isn't so much around fuel cell technology in and of itself. It's more that, like, can everyone please remember that transporting and storing hydrogen is incredibly hard and difficult? And, like, you know, if anyone really wants to look, like, look at the billions of euros or dollars that are spent in subsidizing just hydrogen fuel stations. And, like, the thing, we already have an electricity grid. We just need to build it out a bit more. And then we need to manage it intelligently and use it better. And so on the flip side, I think in terms of flexibility, I'd expect that we'd see probably, you know, several hundred thousand vehicle to grid enabled vehicles, you know, kind of connected and actually being used as grid assets as well as kind of mobility assets. I'd expect that, you know, in the context of, for example, the UK balancing mechanism, that a third of all resources are aggregated kind of small loads and not big power stations. And yeah, those are maybe two things.
So electrification of transport in particular going faster and faster, continues to outbeat forecasts. I don't know if that, well, hopefully the LCB Delta forecasts are more realistic than the BNA forecast, we'll see. And more flexibility. I like that metric, third of all balancing coming from distributed assets.
Would be great.
Sandra, I don't know what you think, setting those sort of goals for the flexibility the system needs, how much is going to come from distributed assets? At the moment, it's small, but we need to be getting up to that a third or that sort of order of magnitude.
I would think we are stupid if we don't get it there.
Yeah.
Because the resources...
It's going to be there.
Yeah, the resources are there anyway, right?
Yeah.
I mean, my neighbor is not going to ask me to buy an electric car because he wants to trade flexibility, but because he wants to have an electric car and drive. Mm. But it comes with the capacity of providing flexibility. So yeah. This is why, I mean, we would be really stupid not to leverage this capacity in addition. And as Alex was saying, if we do it in an intelligent and consumer-centric way, the client will not even realize it.
Yeah.
Right? Because he will still have the car to drive, but we will have this additional value. So,
and they'll save money and they'll yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I think maybe one last point, John, that, you know, that I think about a lot, and maybe it's, you know, it's a bit of a UK specific example, but I think the same thing is true generally. You know, flexibility is not a new topic. Flexibility has been around for as long as we've had an electricity system, because it's balancing supply and demand. But what we're really talking about is the net need of flexibility is increasing exponentially for every energy system as we move from kind of dispatchable generation to intermittent generation as we get more and more renewables. And on top of that, so like the UK system runs on what I think 60 gigawatts of flexibility today. You know, 95% of that is thermal, or, you know, yeah. Let's call it what it is, gas. But, you know, by 2040 to 2050, even like a middling forecast from, you know, like the kind of not the like the super ambitious forecast and not the most pessimistic, like the middle forecast, says the UK system will need somewhere around 210 gigawatts of flexibility to operate. So that's, you know, that's a substantial increase. Bear in mind that actually 50 gigawatts or 55 gigawatts of the 60 used today will actually be gone. So you have a net replacement of that plus new. Mm-hmm. But I'm really not worried about it because, like, we've got gigawatts of front-of-the-meter batteries that are in the pipeline to be built. we've got millions of EVs and heat pumps and home batteries that are going to be for, and, you know, industrial processes that are being electrified more and more. Like, it's like, to Sandra's point, the resource and asset base is there. It's just about a kind of shaking off the cobweb thinking about everything has to look like a gas power station for me to trust it from a kind of, you know, TSO perspective. And then that, you know, innovators and new businesses are able to create those solutions and propositions that get the end customer, whether that is a, you know, an EV driver or a heat pump owner in their house or a factory manager, to kind of get a good deal and without impacting their primary needs.
Alex, I think that's a lovely way to sum up the discussion, actually. And that's what we're all aiming towards, and Octopus is trailblazing the way towards that. So thanks so much for your time and sharing your thoughts. It's been a fascinating discussion. And Sandra, any reflections from your side on the discussion?
So first of all, thank you for that interesting discussion. I think my key takeaway is, again, that there are newcomers who manage to play under the existing regulation towards the energy transition to bring it forward. And the key part of the solution is really to put the consumer in the focus of all its thinking. And there are other newcomers as well, right? In Germany, in Austria, etc., and many more. But the more I look at them in general, the more I see this consumer-centric approach is crucial to all of them. And then for sure, there is an advantage because they can build up on a greenfield area, right? Yep. Or the IT, etc. They don't have all these legacies. But I think also having the appetite to take some risk and to be aware, okay, something can go wrong, but it doesn't have to, I think is crucial to move forward. And this is really something I'm missing in the existing industry.
And I think it's the way that plays into the culture of a company like Octopus, the culture and the ethos.
Exactly.
One of the first podcasts on Talking New Energy was with Greg Jackson, the founder and CEO of Octopus. And he was telling me about how we spoke to customers every day, I think. And that leadership and that culture and that customer obsession then permeates. Culture is like quite fluid when a company is young, but as a company grows, the culture calcifies. And I think what Octopus has done is really embedded that fantastic customer-centric tech fast-moving culture that Alex described to us today.
And would you add any additional point, John? Like what would be your key takeaway?
Probably your one, and then the can-do attitude and the creating the future. It's easy to moan or complain about regulation and policy. We all do it, and it does. Poor regulators and policymakers are stuck in the middle. But there's a lot that can be done today, and making the most of what can be done today and creating the future, I think.
Mm-hmm. Great.
Okay. Well, let's leave it there for today. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Hope you enjoyed the episode and look forward to welcoming you back next week.
Thanks, John. Thanks, Sandra.
Thank you very much.
Goodbye.
Thanks for tuning in. We are excited to bring you captivating conversations from the leading edge of Europe's energy transitions. If you got suggestions for topics or guests for future episodes, please let us know.
And if you're enjoying the podcast, then please do rate it and share it with colleagues. For show notes, transcripts, and more, please visit lcpdelta.com.